Chapter 9. "Do you have any idea what that stuff is?" Frank asked. He and Tony had spent most of the morning analyzing the last group of scans of the valley, which revealed something of interest along the base of the southern mountains. "Not a clue," Tony admitted, scratching the back of his neck. "It looks like rock, maybe with a thin layer of topsoil over it." "Maybe, but look here and here," Frank noted, pointing at several places on the displayed images. "It looks too porous to be rock, don't you think?" Tony was baffled. Although he had some training in geology in order to deal with excavation requirements during construction of the starter colony, this was beyond his education. "Will would know what it was," he admitted. "Probably," Frank agreed, solemnly. He didn't need anyone to remind him that Jack and Will were still missing. "Can the computer tell us anything?" "No, it just keeps spitting out the same response. Insufficient data to speculate." "So much for artificial intelligence," he quipped. "Well, do we really need to know at this point? I mean, there's no way we're going to build the colony there anyway, not that close to the edge." "You're probably right," Frank admitted. "But we still need to know before we can build anywhere. It might not be anything to worry about, but then again..." Tony nodded, knowing that Frank was right. "Guess we're going to have to go out and take a look to be sure." "Probably, but there's no hurry right now." Frank looked at the images again, focusing his attention on the base of the mountains at the far left edge of the monitor. Though most of the mountains were steep, there was one area near the bottom left of the screen that looked like it might provide a navigable path up the ridge. "Do you have any more images over this way?" Frank asked, pointing to the image of the mountain base. "No, this is the last leg of the search pattern. Why do you ask?"
"Just curious," Frank lied.
"How high were you flying that thing?"
"About 500 meters."
"Is that as high as it can go?"
"Not by a long shot. That baby can climb to at least 2,000, Tony boasted. "I just didn't want to risk losing signal integrity and control of the aircraft."
Frank considered their options for a moment. "It has auto-flight capabilities, right?"
"Sure. That's how we got it to fly a standard search pattern. I doubt that I could have flown it accurately enough to gather these images without it."
"So you could load it with pretty much any instructions you wanted, even ones that could take it beyond control range?"
"I guess so, but why?"
"Look here, at this incline. It almost looks like a path up the ridge, doesn't it?"
"Yeah, kind of."
"I'd like to get a better view of that area, all the way up to the summit, if possible."
"Why?"
Frank smiled. "Just humor me, okay?"
"Sure."
"How long will it take you to write up the flight instructions?"
"An hour, maybe?"
"Okay, we'll work on it tonight. We can put it back up in the air tomorrow morning."
"I'm going to have to clear it with Lynn first."
"Yeah, I know. Leave that to me."
"Okay, people, settle down so we can get this over with."
Lynn had become accustomed to raising her voice to get their attention. The evening meal seemed to be the time when everyone was most raucous, but after a month in command, she no longer needed Frank's assistance to get them under control, and within seconds of her request, the group was quiet and attentive.
"Let's have a status report. Medical?"
"I've completed the 4th weekly review," Maria reported. "Other than a few of us who have not been working hard enough to get back up to their physical peak after 4 months of zero gravity, there is nothing significant to report. No biochemical changes have been detected as a result of prolonged exposure to an alien environment."
"Well, that's good news," Lynn agreed.
"So, I feel comfortable in reducing the frequency of the physical exams and lab draws," Maria added.
The room erupted in celebration, drowning her out completely.
"However," Maria yelled over the cheering, "however, I remind you that we will still be doing them at least weekly until further notice."
"Is that necessary?" Lynn asked.
"I'm afraid so.
We've only been here for a month, Lynn. There may be things out there with much longer incubation periods, and there may also be things we simply haven't been exposed to yet."
"It's only once a week, people," Maria said, casting stern glares at the rest of the group.
Contrary to popular opinion, I am not a vampire, she joked.
Very well, Lynn agreed. Post an exam schedule, and we'll continue doing the exams in the morning.
I'll have a schedule for you by lunch, Maria promised.
Biology?
Adia cleared her throat. I've finished processing the first batch of samples. I've looked at over 300 different organisms so far, everything from insects to rodents, and all from within the safe perimeter. Nothing poses a threat to us so far.
Excellent, Lynn nodded. What's next?
I'm going to concentrate on larger animals and birds.
When will you be expanding your sample collecting to outside the perimeter?
She wasn't pressuring her. She was just curious.
After I finish with the next group of organisms, maybe 2 weeks? I don't expect to find much outside the perimeter that I haven't already found around here, with the exception of the beach areas.
Maybe you can focus your first work outside the perimeter, along the coast, Tony chimed in. It would be important for us to know the differences between the two environments before we select a building site.
Yes, of course, Adia promised.
Okay.
Lynn turned her attention to Laura.
Genetics?
Well, I've taken a wide variety of samples, a few from each category, Laura reported. Bugs, sea life, freshwater life, land animals, and birds, along with several plants from each area. As best as I can tell, they all use double helix DNA strands, just like on Earth, she announced proudly. That discovery alone ought to get my name into the history books.
Nothing troublesome? Lynn asked.
No, but I haven't really looked at their genetic interactions with Earth-based DNA yet. I've just been looking for anything at the strand level that might be different than what we already know about DNA, Laura explained. It will take years to analyze just the samples I've collected so far, maybe decades to analyze every living organism within this valley.
Laura could tell that this fact troubled Lynn.
However, according to protocol, if any of the other departments find something of concern, I will concentrate my efforts on that issue instead of trying to get through as many organisms as possible.
Very well.
Lynn didn't really know the protocols that governed the actions of the scientific members of her team. They were long, complicated algorithms that made her eyes cross.
Ag? Lynn asked, turning to Sarah.
I should be harvesting the first group of earth and earth soil crops within a few days, Sarah announced.
Again, the room erupted with cheers. Other than the fresh bread Laura had baked recently, they had been eating freeze-dried, dehydrated food for months, and they were looking forward to a fresh harvest.
Thank you, Sarah preened, enjoying their praise. After that, I should be harvesting something every 10 days or so. The earth and seti crops seem to be doing fine, although the color of some of the plants doesn't seem quite right. I may need to add some soil constituents to the next batch.
Will they be safe to eat? Lynn wondered.
No,
Sarah said emphatically, surprised that Lynn would even suggest such a thing. At least not until biology, medical, and genetics have all given their approval.
Of course, Lynn agreed,
embarrassed by her error.
I am going to need to gather more soil samples from all over the valley if I'm going to complete my soil analysis in time for Tony to recommend a building site.
Sarah took every available opportunity to remind everyone that she was more than just a farmer.
Very well, Sarah. We'll get you out to collect within the next few days.
We're almost finished with our aerial recon, Tony interjected.
I'm going to need her soil report soon, he pointed out.
All right. You can take her out tomorrow morning, Tony.
Sarah beamed, satisfied that she had made her point.
That's not going to work, Frank warned her. Tony and I have to run one last pass at the southern baseline.
I thought you finished that yesterday.
Well, we found an area near the base where we can't make out the topography. There's something strange we can't identify.
All right. Mac can take her out to gather the samples.
Sarah opened her mouth to object, but Mac beat her to the punch.
I've got my own work to do, Mac complained. I don't have time to babysit Dirt Girl.
I don't need anyone to babysit me, Sarah protested, fuming.
Mission protocols. No one leaves the safe perimeter alone. You know that.
Lynn turned to Mac.
What is it you have to do tomorrow?
I gotta move the water intake and clean out the filters. They keep getting clogged up by all that green crap in the river.
It's called algae, moron, Sarah jabbed.
I don't care what it's called. I just don't want to drink it.
That's enough. How full are the storage tanks?
We're at about 3/4 capacity, Mac replied.
Then I think we can last another day without the water plant. Just shut it down until you get back.
Mac wasn't happy, and neither was Sarah. She had enjoyed the peace and quiet since Mac had become buried with maintenance work.
Anything else to add from your department, Tony?
Nope.
Tony looked at Frank, wondering why he hadn't told Lynn everything.
Mac?
Nope, Mac answered, still pouting.
How about you, Frank? Everything okay in engineering?
Yep. Everything that can be repaired has been repaired. Everything that can't, hasn't.
It was a rather short response, blunt and direct, and uncharacteristic for Frank.
All right, Lynn responded, not wanting to provoke him. I guess that does it.
Lynn stood up and left the table, heading for the shower. Frank also rose, heading forward. Tony followed, catching up to him in the forward passageway.
What the hell was that all about? Tony demanded.
What was what about? Frank responded, innocently.
Why did you lie to Lynn back there?
I didn't lie to her.
I thought that you wanted to take a look at the ridgeline.
Ridgeline, baseline, same thing.
Not from 2,000 meters it isn't, Tony protested. Look, Frank, I don't mind helping you with whatever you're up to, but I would like to know what I'm getting into.
You're not getting into anything, Frank defended.
Bullshit!
Look, Frank said impatiently, as he spun around to face Tony. Are you going to fly the damn thing or not?
Yes, I'm going to fly it, Tony exclaimed.
If he didn't fly it, he knew that Frank would, and Frank might crash in the effort.
Good. Thank you.
Frank turned back around. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have work to do. Tony stood there as Frank walked down the boarding ramp and stepped through the exterior hatch. He knew that Frank was up to something. He just didn't know what it was yet. Will had been successful in sharpening the long screwdriver by rubbing its tip against an unusually hard rock. With its new, sharper tip, it served quite well to hollow out the middle of his piece of wood.
"You're looking somber this evening, Jack,"
Will commented, noticing how quiet Jack had been.
"Something on your mind?"
"No, not really." Jack picked up another piece of wood and tossed it into the fire. "I was just thinking about my family," he confessed.
"Oh, yes. I know what you mean."
Jack poked at the fire with a long stick, stirring up its embers.
"What do you miss the most?"
Will set down his work for a moment, thinking about the question.
"Well, I would have to say that I miss the day-to-day routine the most."
Will resumed carving out the middle of his recorder.
"I know some people hate the routine of day-to-day life, but I enjoy it. It's comforting to me, knowing what to expect from one moment to the next."
Will stared at the fire, remembering.
"Up in the morning, a cup of tea, a shower, kiss Abby and Kayla goodbye, walk Michael to class, then off to work. Then lunch with Abby at the mid-deck buffet, more work, then meet the family at the cafeteria for dinner. Then it's home for some family time before the kids go to bed, and then the rest of the evening is for us."
Will stopped whittling again.
"That was my life. Boring, yes, but it's what I miss."
"I know what you mean."
"I'm sure your days were not as mundane," Will said.
"Mundane? No. I've been in training for this mission since just after my son's birth, so my day-to-day routine was never the same. I do miss our Sundays, though. I got a half-day off here and there, but I never trained on Sundays. That was my day to spend with my family."
"I see."
"We used to spend the morning playing on the garden deck. Matt and I would play catch. We'd eat lunch under the simulated blue sky. Tanya wanted to get them used to the idea of a sky. She used to make Matthew take the long route to class, forcing him to go through the garden deck,
as if he were walking to school on the new world. She even made them watch old documentaries from Earth, thinking that it would help prepare them for their life here.
Not a bad idea, really.
No, it's not. Jack sat silently, watching the fire dance around the glowing woodpile. She was always thinking about things like that. Always planning ahead.
How did you and Tanya get together?
Will asked. He already knew the answer. The population of the Daedalus averaged around 200 men, women, and children, and everyone pretty much knew each other to some extent. But it was a good way to pass the time. We used to play together when we were growing up. You remember? Tanya, Frank, Bobby, and me. We all grew up in the same section. We all had a crush on her when we were kids. But she seemed more interested in Bobby than anyone else. I guess when he was killed, she decided to settle for me. But I didn't care. Any way that I could have her was fine by me, he admitted. I remember the day we were joined. Everyone gathered in the garden deck, their uniforms all cleaned and pressed. She was so beautiful, so graceful as she strolled down the aisle. It was like I was watching an angel.
I remember that day, Will recalled.
He and his wife had left their son with Will's mother for the day to attend the joining. Everyone knew that it was a real union, something that didn't happen very often, and they all wanted to be there to witness the event.
You were there?
Of course. I didn't know, Jack admitted, slightly embarrassed.
I'm not surprised, as starry-eyed as you were.
Yeah, I was, wasn't I? Jack laughed. Hell, I remember my heart was beating so fast I could barely recite my vows.
It was a happy day for everyone.
Not everyone, Jack said. Frank was furious with me. He had a thing for her as well. It was months before we spoke again.
I didn't know that.
Oh, it's all in the past. How's that thing coming? Jack asked, wanting to change the subject.
Not too bad. A few more days, and I should be ready to start drilling the holes.
Will handed his work to Jack for inspection.
Hey, this is pretty good work, Will.
Jack looked the would-be recorder over, rotating it around and peering inside it. It was long and smooth, nearly perfectly straight and round, with a pale rose color to the wood.
Where'd you learn how to whittle?
Self-taught, Will boasted.
He was actually surprised at how well it was going thus far.
Really?
Jack asked, in surprise, as he handed the piece of wood back to Will.
Not bad.
Thanks.
Jack stretched his weary joints. The day's travels had been unusually difficult. The jungle here was thick and overgrown, and it slowed them down.
Mind taking the first watch? He asked.
Not at all, Will assured him. I wanted to work on this a little while longer anyway.
Thanks. I'm beat.
Get some sleep. I'll wake you in a few hours.
Good night.
Good night, Jack.
Will watched as Jack crawled into his tent and closed the flap. He looked up at the night sky. The moonlight was unusual here, with two moons casting shadows of different colors from different directions. The closest moon, Luna Proxima, moved quickly across the sky from east to west, and cast an eerie amber light across the planet. The farther moon, Luna Dista, plodded slowly around the planet in the same direction. Brighter than its closer, smaller sister, Dista cast a bright, light blue shadow. Dista took about a month to complete its orbit, while they had seen Proxima complete nearly three orbits since their arrival. Dista seemed to travel the same line on its orbit around the planet. But it appeared that Proxima was climbing higher with each orbit, and now it was coming quite close to the orbit of Dista. Will pondered the possible effects of two moons in such close proximity to one another. Would their respective gravities have an effect on their overall shape? Would it cause their cores to remain molten longer than usual, the pull of gravity churning up the molten metal deep inside their centers? And what effect would it have on this planet's core? Or its tides.
The Daedalus had been forced to depart without an advance probe capable of determining such things. And what little they knew about the worlds of the Tau Ceti system had been gathered on the Icarus's approach to the system via simple, direct observation. Determining the finer details of the planet's geology, as well as the orbital mechanics and effects of her two satellites, were Will's responsibility during the mission. He would have to remember to discuss it with Jack later. For now, he would just enjoy the beauty of the multicolored shadows on the ground around him.
"What do you think?" Jack asked, as he looked out across the river, holding his hand up to shade his eyes from the morning sun.
"It looks shallow enough, I guess."
"Maybe, but it looks a little swift."
"I don't remember seeing any place that looked much better."
"Yeah." Jack took a deep breath and exhaled slowly. "Well, let's get started."
Jack took off his pack and removed the 50-meter rope, tying one end around his waist and the other end around Will's. After pulling his pack back on, he marched toward the river. Jack was the first to go in, stepping carefully on the rocky riverbed. The river was only knee-deep, but the water was moving swiftly past him, and he had to move carefully to keep from being knocked down by the rushing current. About halfway across, he ran out of rope, forcing Will to follow him into the river. The river became a little deeper further out, rising to the middle of Jack's thighs, and now he was forced to lean upstream in order to remain upright while he traversed the mighty river.
"I don't know about this,"
Will called out from his side of the river.
"It's looking pretty deep where you're at."
"It's only mid-thigh," Jack answered. "Don't worry,"
he assured Will. "I'll belay you from the far side."
"Of course," Will muttered to himself, "assuming that you make it that far."
By this time, Jack was in up to his crotch, and he was leaning with his back into the current, sidestepping his way across. Suddenly, he stopped.
"Shit!
What's wrong?"
"My foot is caught on something."
Jack reached down into the water, struggling to get his foot free.
"What is it?"
"I don't know. A plant or something."
Jack reached down deeper, feeling around his foot. It did feel like a plant. The upper portions had leaves, long and narrow, attached to a long, thick trunk that was wrapped around his right foot. Jack reached down to try to untangle himself, but failed. Sliding his hand down further, he grabbed the trunk tightly and pulled hard, trying to rip the plant from the riverbed. It resisted for several seconds, but finally gave way, sending Jack falling to his left, into the river. When he fell, Jack tumbled over onto his stomach. His pack seemed to be floating on the surface, but he was dangling underneath it, face down in the water. He opened his eyes and saw the river bottom passing beneath him as he was swept downstream. After a few moments of struggling, Jack managed to right himself and get his face out of the water to breathe again. Sputtering and coughing, he reached for the bottom with his feet, but found nothing but water. The only thing keeping him afloat was his backpack. As heavy as it was, its airtight compartments were giving it considerable buoyancy. In only that few seconds of panic, the slack on Jack's line ran out, yanking Will off his feet and dragging him downstream as well. Will was still in relatively shallow water, and he bounced off one rock after another as he struggled to get control. The tension on the line was dragging him farther toward the center of the river, and soon, Will was also in, over his head. Just like Jack, Will quickly realized that his backpack was buoyant and rolled over onto his back. Now that he was floating freely in the water, the tension on the line eased up. Will splashed wildly, spinning himself around to face downstream. He could see Jack bobbing in the current about 15 meters ahead of him. Even worse, he could see the white water in the distance. Jack was the first to enter the rushing water, sliding down a gentle waterfall into a trough of water before bobbing back up on the far side. He repeated the process several times, white water splashing up over his head with each successive undulation. He quickly managed to time his breaths during the peaks when he wasn't submerged. But ahead of him, he could see many more rocks sticking up out of the water. As if that weren't enough, there were also large branches protruding from the water, like sharp thorns,
waiting to rip him apart. Jack had to think fast. If he could manage to steer himself, he might be able to keep from being smashed up against any obstacles. But for how long? And could Will do the same? Jack looked over his left shoulder to try to catch a glimpse of Will, but he wasn't there. He looked over his right shoulder. There he was, splashing frantically. The current had somehow carried him a little further across than Jack. He looked downstream again. There was a large rock, maybe 10 meters across, sticking up at least a meter above the water. The river was pounding against the rock's upstream face, sending a wake of white water violently splashing up over it. There was a clear channel of smooth green water running past either side of the rock, offering safe passage on both the right and left. That was exactly what he needed. He turned to look at Will again.
"Will!" he hollered at the top of his lungs. "Swim that way!" he yelled, waving his right arm toward the far shore, nearly rolling back over onto his stomach in the process.
The command wasn't necessary, as the far shore was the closest point of land to Will, and he was already trying desperately to get to that side. Jack watched as Will flailed, trying to paddle his way across the current, keeping a shaky balance on his back, his backpack keeping his head above water. Jack turned his attention forward again, kicking hard and paddling with his arms to make sure he passed to the left of the rock. Within seconds, he closed on the rock and slid by to its left, riding down the falling wave. He could feel the rope as it dragged across the face of the rock, but all he could do was pray that Will passed the rock on the opposite side. Will also closed quickly on the rock. He was trying with all his might to get to the far shore, but what had worked before was not working now. It was like something was pulling him back toward the center of the river. He could feel something holding him back, but he had no idea what it was. For a few seconds, Will was sure he was going to slam into the rock. But by some miracle, the current carried him to the left, barely missing a direct impact, as he too rode the white wave down into the smooth green water on the opposite side. Jack suddenly stopped dead in the water, a huge wake forming around his back that threatened to pull him under. The rope dug painfully into his waist, making it hard to breathe. But his plan had worked. He stopped. The rope dug into Will's waist as well, as he swung in toward the center of the river in a graceful arc. He ended up in the calmer water just downstream of the rock, where he felt a wonderful sensation. Sand. There was sand under his feet. Will planted his feet to steady himself, leaning back into the current, his feet sinking deep into the soft sand. He looked on both sides. The water was rapid on either side of him, but it was relatively calm in the middle, where he was. He positioned his feet directly under him and carefully stood up. The water was only waist-deep here, swirling about him harmlessly. He couldn't believe his luck. He was standing on a sandbar, probably formed by the currents passing on either side of the rock. Then he heard Jack's cries for help. He spun around to look downstream. 12 meters away was Jack, buried in a white wake of water, dangling at the end of the rope. Jack was hanging just past the point where the water flow from either side of the rock converged and had not been carried into the shallow water in the same way. Will quickly grabbed the rope behind him. Pulling up the slack as he went, he took a few steps upstream toward the rock. Afraid to untie the rope from around his waist, he reached over and grabbed Jack's line on the other side of the rock and pulled with all his might. Jack felt incredibly heavy with so much water rushing over him. Will pulled with strength, fueled by adrenaline, slowly hauling Jack upstream and out of the mighty current. Finally, after several minutes of struggling, Jack was in the calmer middle waters.
"Put your feet down," Will called out to him. "There's a sandbar beneath you."
Jack had no idea what Will was talking about. He hadn't even noticed that he was moving upstream. He just thought the current had suddenly become stronger. But he followed Will's suggestion and soon found himself standing in calm, thigh-deep water. Jack stood for a moment, panting in disbelief. Finally, he turned around to face upstream and saw Will leaning against the rock, exhausted. He started walking upstream along the sandbar toward Will, closing the gap between them with relative ease.
"Are you all right?" he asked as he approached.
"You're welcome,"
Will sputtered in between breaths. Jack joined him against the rock to rest for a moment. He looked to his left, gazing at the water passing by him in a torrential current of white and green madness.
"Now what do we do?"
Will asked.
"Let's get these packs off and get up on this rock, where it's safe," Jack suggested.
Will didn't need to be asked twice to get out of the river. He slung his pack off his shoulders and pushed it up onto the rock, water draining off of it, running down the face of the rock. Jack gave him a boost up, and Will flopped down onto the top of the rock, rolling over onto his back. Jack tossed up his pack as well and joined him. They both lay there for several minutes, resting as the water raged around them, saying nothing.
"Thanks, Will,"
Jack finally said, reaching out and patting his friend on the chest.
"My pleasure."